Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta, Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki.
Jai.
Those who are saturated with the transcendental happiness of rendering service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead are uninterested even in the achievements of great mystics, for such achievements do not enhance the transcendental bliss felt by a devotee who always thinks of Krishna within the core of his heart. Purport. Excuse me. A pure devotee is uninterested not only in elevation to higher planetary systems, but even in the perfections of mystic yoga. Real perfection is devotional service. The happiness derived from merging in the impersonal Brahman and the happiness derived from the eight perfections of mystic yoga, anima, lagima, prapti, and so on, do not give any pleasure to the devotee. As stated by Srila Prabhupada Saraswati, kaivalyam narakayate tridas pur akasha pushpayate durtantendriya kala sarpa patali putkata damsrayate vishvam purna sukhayate vidi mahindradis cha kitayate yat karunya kataksha vaibhava vatam tam guru ram evashtumaha. Chaitanya Chandramrita 5. When a devotee has achieved the position of rendering transcendental loving service to the Lord through the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, he thinks the impersonal Brahman to be no better than hell, and he regards material happiness in the heavenly planets to be like a will-o'-the-wisp. As far as the perfection of mystic powers is concerned, a devotee compares it to a venomous snake with no teeth. A mystic yogi is especially concerned with controlling the senses, but because the senses of a devotee are engaged in the service of the Lord, Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam Bhaktiruchate, there is no need for separate control of the senses. For those who are materially engaged, control of the senses is required, but a devotee's senses are all engaged in the service of the Lord, which means that they are already controlled. Param drishtva nivartate, Bhagavad Gita 2:59. A devotee's senses are not attracted by material enjoyment, and even though the material world is full of misery, the devotee considers this material world to be also spiritual because everything is engaged in the service of the Lord. The difference between the spiritual world and material world is the mentality of service. Nirbandha Krishna Sambande Yuktam Vairakyam Uchate. When there is no mentality of service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one's activities are material. Prapanchi kataya buddha hari sambandhi vastunaha mumukshubi parityagyo vairakyam falgu kachate. Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 1:256. That which is not engaged in the service of the Lord is material, and nothing thus engaged should be given up. That which is not engaged in the service of the Lord is material, and nothing thus engaged should be given up. In the construction of a high skyscraper and the construction of a temple, there may be the same enthusiasm, but the endeavors are different, for one is material and the other spiritual. Spiritual activities should not be confused with material activities and given up. Nothing connected with Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is material. A devotee who considers all this is always situated in spiritual activities, and therefore he is no longer affected by material activities. Param drishtva nivartate. Om Gyana Chimarandasya Jananjana Shilagaya Chakshur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadara Shri Vasari Gaura Bhaktavrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, yesterday, Adiguru Prabhu very nicely explained how we are not interested in material opulence and heavenly planets and all this. And today, we are dealing with the mystic yogic powers. And the conclusion is, of course, the same. We're not interested. I was reading through this verse in purport, and actually this is one of these purport where after reading it, I just want to go, any questions? Because Prabhupada just explains so nicely and completely. But I'm sitting here, so I think maybe I should say something. The yogis follow the process of yoga. Patanjali has a yoga system called Astanga Yoga, the Eightfold Yoga Path. And through this process, the object is to control the mind, withdraw the senses, and enter into uninterrupted trance. So it's very focused on the mind, controlling the mind. And as such, we don't really disagree with that. So these eight steps begin with what is called yama, which is self-control or restrictions in activities. So they consist of five elements: non-violence, truthfulness or non-lying, non-stealing, brahmacharya, celibacy, and non-possessiveness. So if you just very quickly go through those. Non-violence means obviously the gross non-violence, you're vegetarian and so on, but also subtle non-violence means non-violence of speech and behavior. Then you have truthfulness towards others, but more importantly, truthfulness towards yourself. Because if you develop a habit of kind of bending reality, then that will manifest in the external, right? If you're lying to others, it's basically because you're lying to yourself. And how will you become realized if you can't even trust what's going on inside your own head? I mean, this behavior becomes a pattern, and that forms our mentality and ultimately our nature. So there's no way that we're going to become self-realized if we start veering away from the truth at any moment. So that's given up. Non-stealing, also pretty obvious, but we should also remember here that we are dealing also with a subtle element. That means non-hankering. We shouldn't see any other's possessions as something I want or I'd like that. This is, you know, things have been arranged a certain way for a certain reason, and we should be content with that. Brahmacharya, celibacy, obviously. But again, also a subtle element that is more important. It means self-control, you know. So obviously we have a lot of gross reactions to not being celibate, but there are also subtle reactions to these hankerings that come up, this lust and this greed. So this should be controlled. And finally, non-possessiveness, because anything that we have a sense of ownership towards, that those things will also own us because we have to maintain them. So these are restrictions within the first step, which is called yama. Next step is called niyama, which are defined as religious conduct, you could say. So these are in the positive. The other was in the negative. Now we go for the positive. What do we do then? Well, first of all, purity. Purity means cleanliness, that's obvious, but again, purity is the subtle form of cleanliness, purity of mind, purity of thought. This is something that is not widely understood in this age, that there's actually, like, you could put something dirty on you and you will become dirty. The same way, if you put something dirty inside your mind becomes dirty. It's a material element, and it takes on the qualities of what it associates with because it's like that. So even stuff like mundane news, you know, it breeds hatred and fear. So associating with this is not recommended if you want to maintain your purity. Instead, you would rather associate with Srimad Bhagavatam or associate with devotees or prasadam or stuff like that, right? So that's purity. Let's see, what have we? Purity, contentment is the next. And contentment is basically just the positive of non-stealing. Because if you're content, you wouldn't even consider stealing or not stealing. So it's the positive of realizing that, well, it doesn't actually do any difference for my happiness, what kind of possessions or facilities I have. This is something we can see if we look at it pretty, just a little bit detached. So whatever I have, that's what I work with. I will be content. The boys in the Gurukul in Mayapur, they're very content because they're being trained in working with whatever they have. They can do anything with whatever they have. They can make magnificent feasts with very little, actually, groceries and things to work with, and they can repair a wall or whatever. So sometimes devotees ask, but what when they get out into the real world? I mean, they're not trained up in the Western world, but that doesn't matter because they're trained up in using whatever they have. So if they suddenly find themselves in New York City, they just have some different stuff, but they're used to just working with whatever they have. So they will be fine because that's a higher principle. The details are what, then what do you have? Okay, that's a detail. You just work with whatever it is. This is the fun part about the Western culture, is that they are very proficient at working with what they have, but if very little is changed in their setup of what facilities they have, they're absolutely useless. So this is actually the conclusion of contentment, is that you just work with whatever you have. That will breed contentment. You will be satisfied with whatever comes. So the next is tapasya, austerity. Usually we would think that tapasya would be in the negative, or you know, you're accepting something uncomfortable, but actually tapas comes from, it actually means generating heat. So you have these yogis who go far up into the Himalayas, and it's extremely cold. Any Western doctor would say you die if you do that, but they go up there and sit there, and they're so self-controlled that the body generates enough heat that they survive this, and they can actually do this. So tapasya means, actually, it doesn't mean, we usually say, oh, that was austere because we were uncomfortable, but we did it anyway. Actually, it means that you're comfortable in an uncomfortable situation because you're not dependent on the externals, you're not disturbed by it. So you're self-controlled and you generate enough heat from within, or, I mean, it's an extension of contentment, you can say, that it's not actually affecting you. So then we have study. Obviously, you would generate knowledge or acquire knowledge if you want to follow some kind of religious principles, because religion means connecting with something that is greater than yourself. So if it's greater than yourself, you have to be humble. This is one of the main symptom of knowledge, that you become humble, and then you acquire new knowledge because you have to, because what you're trying to connect with is greater than yourself. So you can't really speculate your way to gain that. And finally, surrender. Surrender doesn't mean, you know, there's this saying, you should have an open mind, but not so open that your brain falls out. So it means, surrender means critical thinking. Usually in the West, we say critical thinking, and we actually mean just comply with the consensus. That's what actually critical thinking means. Critical thinking means I will dismiss anything that disagrees with my views because I'm critical. You know, actually, critical thinking means detachment and intelligence. You see who is actually a bona fide authority, who is not actually a bona fide authority, and then you surrender to that authority. And yeah, obviously, act on that. It's always important in the Vedic that there's always some kind of conclusion. That's in the modern, conclusions are deadly because then the speculation stops and you have to start acting on it. We don't want that. So, but in the Vedic, we are only using intelligence as a tool to get to a conclusion so we can progress, right? So these are yama and niyama. And then third step in the Ashtanga yoga system is asana. And this is where we start to curl up like a pretzel and do all these funky positions. And it's a way of controlling the gross senses so they don't run wild and run off with us. We all know the cover of the Bhagavad Gita, the five horses are the senses that are just racing off with us. And this is a way of controlling that so that we may find some inner peace. It's said there are 84 bona fide asanas, and 80 of them are just to stop disturbance, actually, and only 4 of them are actually minded on the positive of meditation. And these are all, you know, you can see these by that. It all has to do with aligning the spine and becoming, you know, very upright. So then there's no disturbance. So then you do that. And after that, you have pranayama. This is the fourth level, which means controlling of the breath. And again, we're dealing with the control of the senses, the control of the life airs comes after that, because then after that, the mind won't be that disturbed. And this is what we're going for, to stop the mind from taking us everywhere. So when you actually achieve perfection is this, in this pranayama, I think they actually stop the breathing. Actually, for over 2 hours, they just stop the breathing, and you have a little bit of air going in one nostril and a little bit of air going out the other nostril, and it just circulates like that. And you've actually controlled your body to that extent where you can live off that. And then you have pratyahara, which means withdrawal of the senses. So now you've stopped them, and now you draw them into the mind, away from the sense objects. So this is actually mind control, because in reality there is no sense control, because the senses are always running wild. The question is, are we acting on it? So now we've gotten them under control, so we can, okay, you can act on that, you can't act on that, right? So, sabji, good. Meat, not good. But now we draw them in, completely detaching them from the sense objects. And this is mind control. This is the true sense control, that the mind is actually not hankering for anything. What happens here is that you find some object to meditate on. It can be a candle, it can be a mantra, it can be some kind of object, and you just fix your mind on that. So after that comes... No, sorry, I just went a little too fast here. Then after that, yes, the sixth step is dharana. This is where you add the mantra. You fix your mind on a mantra or a light or an object or a wall or whatever it is. And then you just sit there and control the mind. This is called one-pointed attention. After that comes jhana, which we know from the Bhagavad Gita, jhana yoga, where you actually stop the mind. And this is where... When you actually stop the fruitive mentality, the mind stops. Then these mystic cities come that Prabhupada is just briefly touching on in this purport. Because Maya is good. When we have hankering, she withdraws. So the material energy is such that if you want it, you can't have it. If you don't want it, you can have it. That's how Maya works. When we start saying no to the material energy, then suddenly it's on offer. You know, we get offers from Maya. Are you sure you don't want this? I mean, you used to want this. I mean, she's just being a good host, actually. She doesn't want us to fall down. She's just like if you're at a function and there's some prasadam and you've taken sabji twice and they come the third time and oh, I really shouldn't. And come on, you seem to like it. You sure you don't want it? Okay, you can take. Come on. That's Maya. That's just what she does, you know. So when we completely say no, I mean, finish, bas, I'm done. And the mind actually stops, the material mind stops. Then everything is possible, and that's why these mystic cities are available. Lighter than the lightest, heavier than the heaviest, bigger than the biggest, smaller than the smallest. I mean, ability to manifest wherever you want and stuff like that. Suddenly you can do stuff like that. And the final... level, the eighth level, and perfection is then samadhi. So this is where you actually add the super soul, and it's just called the perfection, what is it? Oh, I forget now. Anyways, it's perfection, and you add the super soul into this, and you have an eternal relationship with God as the super soul in the heart. So this is interesting because yoga is actually, it builds on the Shankhya system, which is Mayavad philosophy, which is impersonalism, it's atheistic Vedic philosophy. But yoga actually has a concept of a God. The Paramatma is God. So it's not that I become God, I have an eternal relationship with the Supreme in my heart. Now, it's still impersonal because there's absolutely no description of what that means. There's no description of any activity, any service rendered, or anything else. It's just you're there, God is there, somehow that's great, you know. So if we take a look at this process of eight steps, there's not really anything that we disagree with as such. I mean, everything, right? It sounded pretty good, all of it, right? What's the problem is that it's kind of turned upside down. And that's what happens every time that we concoct something. This is basically, you know, yoga from Vedanta. It's a part of Vedanta. But here, yoga has been taken as the prominent. This mind control has become the prominent, and the rest has become into like stepping stones to achieve that. And how can we see that? We can see that by, where is devotion in this whole step, in this program we went through? Where is the devotion? Well, devotion actually falls under the heading of surrender in the niyama category, the second step. The surrender, that means that's where they classify the devotion. And it's described how surrendering in devotion to the Lord can be a effective tool in achieving self-realization. So that's not very nice, that you're actually using God as a tool in your preliminary steps towards your great austere achievements of attaining self-realization. Already before they're curling up as a pretzel, they're done with the Lord. They've been there, done that. Now let's get out to some real funky stuff, you know. And this is why it doesn't work. It doesn't work. They go all the way up to Samadhi, but just before Samadhi, Jhana comes and they get these mystic cities. And that's when you really realize that this is working. You are doing stuff that nobody else can do. You are in total control of the material energy. Does that sound familiar? And you fall down. So that's one thing, is that you can go up and down like this for however many lifetimes you want. Another thing is that you generally don't do this in one lifetime. This takes thousands of lifetimes to achieve this. I mean, halfway there, you have to stop the breathing for more than 2 hours. You're not even fixed yet, you know. So does this sound like something we want, you know, compared to, let's say, chanting, dancing, and feasting? Gives the same result, exactly the same result. Only thing is, we start by adding Paramatma. That's the first thing we do. On the level of Shraddha to Prem, first thing we do is to realize that this is not done by my achievements. I'm not doing this. I'm assisting the Paramatma in doing this, and Paramatma is sanctioning everything that's going on. And when that is realized, then we don't need all this tapasya, because it's not us doing it anyway, right? There are two ways of serving the Lord. You serve Him as a person, or you serve the rules by which things govern. Even the most gross materialist is serving God's laws. You know, he's not flying around. Gravity works for him also. It's the same way fire works. It's the same way that the kitchen sink works. You know, it's the material energy is the same. Only thing is that we're doing it as a service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whatever it is we're doing, and he's doing it for sense gratification. The rules are the same. The result is different. So because we're doing it as a service to the Lord, we are instruments in the Lord's Leela. He's not an instrument in my Leela. That means that he does it. So it's not very difficult. Prabhupada also mentions in this purport that because every activity we perform is in service of the Lord, there is no need for sense control because the senses are already controlled. There is no need for this non-possessiveness, because it doesn't matter how many possessions we have, it's still Krishna's possessions. It's Krishna's family, I'm just taking care of it. It's Krishna's bead bag, I'm just chanting on it. Whatever it is, it's still Krishna's. So then this rigid control, it's not necessary. So this is pretty nice. So you can see that you have actually the two first steps in the yoga system is basically all your world religions are in this, in these two steps. You have something you don't do and something you do. Basically, pretty easy to understand, and it's all the same. You know, basically just don't be an idiot. That's the gist of it, you know. And that's good, because if we look out outside the window at the world going on there, basically they're not even on that level. They're not even, because why are you restricting me in my attempt to be unique? I'm a good person. Why shouldn't I be allowed to be unique? So I want to be good. I want to be a good person in another way than you want to be a good person. Why is your way better than my way? So this is something that we sometimes hear, you know. Some are not as outspoken about it, but we generally see this behavior. So in that sense, yoga it can work, but it is dependent on some externals. First of all, it's dependent on you have somewhere to perform it. Like in devotion, we can perform anywhere. It's all Krishna, so whatever we have, that's what we were saying before. Whatever you're working with, that's Krishna's energy, so you can do that. Achieving samadhi on the tube in London, I don't think it's gonna happen, you know. And this whole thing about mystic cities, I mean, we're as devotees, we're not really interested in it. That's the whole purport of the Jai Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nandaki, Jai Shri Shri Sita Ram Lakshman Hanumanaki, Jai Goranitai Ki. Mystic cities is not really a big deal for us because it's happening everywhere. It's always something mystic cities is going on. You know, I have one story from Mayapur. I like to chant before the Mangala Arati at Mayapur, and I'm walking to the temple. It's 3 a.m. in the morning, and an ambassador comes towards me, and it stops right in front of me. And this is unusual because I'm inside the Mayapur compound. Usually cars don't drive in there. It's strange, but it comes there, and this black guy gets out with an acoustic guitar. And he's come from South India because he heard that it was Kirtan Mela and he never heard about it before. Someone described it and he just wanted to see 4,000 people chanting. So, and it was Kirtan Mela, so yeah. So I decided I would try and help him to, you know, get settled. 3 a.m. in the morning is not the easiest thing. So, and so the driver got out and he started to heckle him for, you know, like Lakshmi. He'd already paid overprice for the trip and now he wanted like a tip. And so I did something with my head and suddenly he looked at me and he turned around, got into his ambassador and drove off. And I had successfully mastered the sideways nod, you know. This is amazing. This is mystical. It can mean anything. It can mean yes and it can mean no. And maybe, and I'm pretty sure it can also mean you white guys are getting on my nerves because I think I've gotten that a couple of times. So this is something that I still don't know how it works, but it works for some mystical, yeah. You know, I think that if you're walking around in Calcutta, that if a white guy comes and you have a walla, fruit walla or something, he just does this. And if you respond, then you get it to like regular price. If you don't respond, suddenly prices are like 10 times as much. I think they can tell, you know, just see what happens. This is very mystical. But nevertheless, it's there and it works. So we're not that impressed by it. The problem is they're impressed by it because they've worked so hard to gain these mystic cities. And when they got there, when they get them, the result is theirs. They've already left God behind on step number 2, and now they have this ability, and they've earned it because they've been trying for several lifetimes to get there. So that is what breaks the concentration and makes them fall down. So in order to relieve them of this situation, of course Krishna is very merciful and he has a solution. This is why Lord Rishabhadev, we hear of the story of Lord Rishabhadev in the Bhagavatam. He was a king and he was extremely beautiful and talented, had 100 sons and ruled the world and everybody was happy. And when it was time to give it all up, he became kind of an avadut. An avadut is a devotee who is not playing by the rules of the social sphere of society. Usually we see that, we say that an Uttam Adhikari, he would go down to the level of Madhyam, where you have some kind of proper conduct in order to preach. An Avadhut doesn't do that. Nityananda is also an Avadhut, and Sukadev Goswami, Avadhut, just running around naked and doing crazy stuff, you know. And Lord Rishabhadev is also an Avadhut, and in his last days he was basically just, you know, like a snake on the ground rolling around and smearing himself in his own feces and urine and kind of, you know, just to make people leave him alone in his samadhi, in his devotional bath to the Lord. And he did it as a means to show these mystic yogis that you can't control the mind. You can't stop the mind. You have to give up the mind. You have to leave it. Very nice point by Prabhu yesterday, I thought, was leave it like when you're done on the toilet. You close the door, you go. You don't really think, did I miss something there? Is there something? No, it's over. You know, you're on to something better. So the same way with the material mind, just give it up and move on. The mystic yogis, they're attached to the mind, and because they're so in control of it, they're so good at it, that attachment is impossible to break. You see someone who's very good at something, it's impossible to break. That's why devotion is the only way. Let's just do the verse again. Those who are saturated with the transcendental happiness of rendering service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead are uninterested even in the achievements of great mystics, for such achievements do not enhance the transcendental bliss felt by a devotee who always thinks of Krishna within the core of his heart. That means the devotion is coming from the heart. Whatever external is just a means of enhancing that devotion. So whatever it is you do, you can do it for Krishna. You don't have to break that attachment on the negative. You don't have to cut yourself off. Whatever it is you're attached to, you can just do it for Krishna. It really doesn't matter if you're a skateboarder or you're, you know, a pujari or whatever it is, just do it for Krishna. And then automatically you will be purified. So the yogic process is a process of stopping, you know, and breaking. And we all know how that goes. You know, you're on a diet for 4 weeks, and 2 weeks after you weigh more than before you were on the diet. Or you stop smoking, and then 2 months after, you're back on a packet of cigarettes a day. It doesn't work. Removing stuff from your life, it doesn't work because the mind is too strong. So we add something. We add devotion. We add a healthier lifestyle instead of stopping to smoke. We add health. You know, this is a mental exercise that actually in the fullest extent only works if you're working in devotion. Because the only happiness that there is Krishna's happiness. We can take part in that happiness, and that's when we feel happy. It's actually Krishna's happiness we are feeling. That's why we have piety and impiety. Because piety is just what Krishna likes. Then we will be happier. Even if you're a total materialist, if you're pious, you're happier than if you're impious. But if you're devoted, piety doesn't work. That's why actually, this is a far out point, but piety is actually sinful. If you look at it as piety, then it's sinful because you're not considering why. You're not considering it as Krishna's pleasure. That's the point of the 11th canto, is that piety only makes sense if you're using it as a tool to preach, to please Krishna. If you're using it as a tool to please yourself, you're a demon. You may be a very nice demon, but I mean, Hiranyakashipu, he was very pious. He was following the Vedas totally. Son goes to Gurukul, everything, you know. So it has to be in devotion. It has to be in devotion. There is no other way. And that automatically takes care of everything. So this is the conclusion of all the Vedas, is that there is only love of God. And everything else should be directed at that. And when we see these different diversions, you know, we have six systems of Vedic philosophy. Vedanta is the only real one. The others are kind of deviations or half-baked versions. Patanjali's yoga system is one of these. And you have some others. Nyaya, that's just logic. Mahaprabhu was in his, before he manifested as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he was into Nyaya and could defeat anyone. And you have Shankhya, which is just Mayavad. You have Karma Mimamsa, which is just a materialistic. So these are all because we add our own ideas. We make the detail into the principle and the principle into the detail. So we make it into our own. Instead of dealing with our anarthas, we are justifying them. And that's what happens if you don't have devotion, because you can't really win over the mind. The mind is too strong unless you accept that it's actually Krishna's Shakti. It's Krishna who's doing it. I'm just putting myself in line as an instrument. Then it'll work. Otherwise, you will end up justifying your anarthas rather than dealing with them. This happens all the time. We see that we think that the material situation I'm doing, that's the devotion. You know, if you're not studying, then you're not a real devotee. Prabhupada said everybody should take Bhakti Shastri. So anyone who's not taken Bhakti Shastri, basically not a devotee. I mean, this is a very gross and direct and strong way to say it, but this point of view is actually not that uncommon. And it's because basically our faith is a little bit lacking. We don't have complete faith, and that's why we're afraid to let go of our anarthas. And when someone points it out, we retaliate rather than take it to heart, right? So this is what we have to build on. We have to build on our faith. Prabhupada says that basically bhava and ultimately prema is just mature faith. It's just mature shraddha. Because faith means faith in something other than myself. Otherwise, I didn't need to have faith. It was just about myself. I would be delusional. But faith means faith in something other than myself. And the ultimate faith in something other than myself, of course, is prema. Because I don't even exist as an entity that has needs. It's all about Krishna. And automatically, all my needs are taken care of. So it's just about faith. How do you do that? You associate with those who have faith. The same way we were talking about the material mind, it takes on the qualities of whatever it associates with. So go to the temple, associate with the devotees, try to get the association of the advanced devotees, and know for sure that whatever they tell you is only for your own good, even though sometimes it hurts. Because that's what we do with the philosophy. We separate what is actually material and spiritual. And sometimes we have to pull off the band-aid, and it seems like it hurts, but it is ultimately for our own good. So now I've been rambling on for some time, and I thought this was so beautiful, so I actually think I will end also with Prabhupada, because there's a purport in Bhagavad Gita that I think fits this theme we're dealing with today very well. So I'll just read that, and then we can take maybe a question or two. This is from the purport to Bhagavad Gita, as it is, chapter 2, entitled Contents of the Gita Summarized, text 70. A Krishna-conscious man is not in need of anything, because the Lord fulfills all his material necessities. Therefore, he is like the ocean, always full in himself. Desires may come to him like the waters of the river that flow into the ocean, but he is steady in his activities, and he is not even slightly disturbed by desires for sense gratification. That is the proof of a Krishna-conscious man. One who has lost all inclinations for material sense gratification, although the desires are present. Because he remains satisfied in the transcendental loving service of the Lord, he can maintain steady, like the ocean, and therefore enjoy full peace. Others, however, who want to fulfill desires, even up to the limit of liberation, what to speak of material success, never attain peace. The fruitive workers, the salvationists, and also the yogis, who are after mystic powers, are all unhappy because of unfulfilled desires. But the person in Krishna consciousness is happy in the service of the Lord, and he has no desires to be fulfilled. In fact, he does not even desire the liberation from the so-called material bondage. The devotees of Krishna have no material desires, and therefore they are in perfect peace. Thank you. Any questions, comments, chastisements? Glorifications of Krishna.